Tony Burnham. Meanwhile, here on FM, our Book of the Week. In May this year, the Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield returned to Earth after 5 months in the command of the International Space Station. In his new book, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth, he reflects on what he learned along the way, in particular, the kind of mindset that is required of someone whose goal it is to leave the planet. The reader is Garrick Hagen.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Lock your Soyuz hatch and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
It's puzzling to me that so many self-help gurus urge people to visualize victory and stop there. Some even insist that if you wish for good things long enough and hard enough, you'll get them. And conversely, that if you focus on the negative, you actually invite bad things to happen. Why make yourself miserable worrying? Why waste time getting ready for disasters that may never happen? I graduated from military college in 1982 with a degree in mechanical engineering and a clear plan. I was going to be a military pilot. The Canadian Forces basic jet training course included 200 hours in a two-seater, accompanied by an instructor who evaluated every flight. If you flew poorly even one time, you were sent for extra training and then had to repeat the flight. A re-ride was a big black mark on a pilot's record. If you got too many, you were kicked out of the program. It didn't help that each re-ride was posted on a huge board. If your name appeared there, other pilots started to treat you as if you were already halfway out the door. Then I made a hash out of one of my instrument exam flights. The instructor was someone I'd never flown with before, so he had no idea whether I was any good or not. And I gave him plenty of reasons to think I wasn't. I flew clumsily, and the instructor noticed every dumb mistake and criticized me roundly, and then grimly started flipping through my record. It was clear he was on the verge of scheduling a re-ride. I sat there, mute with shame, staring straight ahead and listening to the sound of pages being turned. After a very long minute, the instructor finally looked up from my file and said, "I see this is the first flight where you've had problems like this, so I'm going to chalk it up to a bad day. No rewrite." It was not just a reprieve, but a life-changing moment. If he hadn't given me the benefit of the doubt, I might well not be an astronaut today. It still haunts me how close I came to blowing my own chances. I was forced to look inside myself to try to figure out why I hadn't been ready. Was I tired, hungover, not assertive enough at the controls? No. The problem was simple. I'd decided I was already a pretty good pilot, good enough that I didn't need to fret over every last detail. And it's true. You don't need to obsess over details if you're willing to roll the dice and accept whatever happens. But if you're striving for excellence, there's no such thing as over-preparation. I had to be ready. Always. I decided to change the way I prepared. Effective immediately. At night, instead of studying in my room, I studied in the airplane I'd be flying the next day. I got out all the checklists and acted out the whole flight, pretending to use the instrument controls. No one told me to go sit in a cold hangar for a couple of hours and run through the flight repeatedly until I could picture the whole thing. No one had to. That near re-ride had redoubled my resolve. Space exploration is inherently dangerous. If my focus ever wavers in the classroom or during an 8-hour simulation, I remind myself of one simple fact. Space flight might kill me. To drive that message home, we have what we euphemistically refer to as contingency sims. Death sims, actually, which force us to think through our own demise in granular detail. Not only how we'd die, but what would happen afterward to our families, colleagues, and the space program itself. Everyone who in real life would be involved in dealing with an astronaut's death takes part around the table. Doctors, space program administrators, media relations people, even the dead astronaut. A death sim starts with a scenario. Chris is seriously injured on orbit, say. And over the next few hours, people work through their own roles and responses. Every 5 to 10 minutes, whoever is running the exercise tosses what we call a green card into the mix. In essence, a new wrinkle. No one else in the sim knows in advance what is on the cards, and we respond as though these things are actually happening. One green card might be, "We've just received word from the station Chris is dead." Immediately, people start working the problem. Okay, what are we going to do with his corpse? There are no body bags on station, so should we shove it in a spacesuit and stick it in a locker? But what about the smell? Should we send it back to Earth on a resupply ship and let it burn up with the rest of the garbage on re-entry? Jettison it during a spacewalk and let it float away into space? While people are discussing how quickly my body would start to decompose and what kind of help my crewmates might need to deal with the trauma, they are hit with another green card. Someone has just tweeted that there's been an accident on the ISS and a New York Times reporter is calling to find out what's going on. New problems while the old ones are still being dealt with. How should the PR people respond? When will a statement be issued and what should it say? The green cards start coming faster and faster, posing new problems, just as would happen in real life. As is probably clear by now, death sims are not weepy, grief-stricken affairs. They're all about brass tacks. Although family members aren't required to participate, Helena has joined in several times, because she has discovered that taking the time to verbalize what you think you would do in the worst-case scenario quickly reveals whether you're really prepared or not. During a contingency sim before Expedition 34-35, for instance, she realized that her plan to trek in the Himalayas while I was in space for 5 months was wonderful, unless something went seriously wrong during my mission. The green cards in the sim forced us to figure out who would contact our kids if I died, quite possibly a reporter, we realized, if their mother was on a mountaintop, and how quickly Helena could get to Houston to be with them. Not very, considering how many connecting flights she'd need to take. The upshot of all this was that Helena decided to save the Himalayas for another year and hike in Utah instead. In fact, everyone who participated in the sim discovered weaknesses in their own planning and went back to the drawing board. While play-acting grim scenarios day in and day out may sound like a good recipe for clinical depression, it's actually weirdly uplifting. Rehearsing for catastrophe has made me positive that I have the problem-solving skills to deal with tough situations and come out the other side smiling. Although simulating a catastrophe does get you accustomed to the idea that it could happen, you're never inured to the point of indifference. I doubt I will ever be able to forget the morning of February the 1st, 2003. I'd flown back to Houston from Russia the night before and forgot to turn my phone back on until Helena and I were driving to brunch in the morning. As soon as I did, I saw I had a massive number of messages. Helena checked her phone, and so did she. We didn't have to listen to them to know something terrible had happened. Our friends on Columbia were coming home that day. We turned the car around and drove back to the house with an awful, awful feeling, like all the air had gone out of everything. I turned on the TV, and immediately there it was. A replay of Columbia's disintegration in the skies, not all that far from our home. My eyes filled with tears even before I'd really processed the information. The sudden, irretrievable loss was devastating. We knew all 7 astronauts on that shuttle. We'd shared the same dream. We cared about their spouses and children. The commander of that mission, Rick Husband, was my classmate at test pilot school. I mourned, and still mourn, his death, and the deaths of our 6 other friends on that flight. I also felt a huge sense of disappointment and responsibility. I was part of a program that had let this happen. When I got to the office an hour or so later, they were already mounting teams to go help pick up the pieces of our colleagues and their spaceship, which had been scattered across the state. I helped out and did what I could for Rick's family, but there wasn't much anyone could do. Highly talented, hardworking, genuinely nice people had been killed doing their jobs, through no fault of their own. It was a terrible, needless waste. Yet I never considered leaving NASA, nor was it ever a topic of discussion with my family. I hadn't been assigned to another shuttle flight and didn't think I ever would be, so there was no threat to my own safety. My job was to help others fly safely, and the Columbia disaster only strengthened my sense of purpose. We had to persuade the world all over again that the shuttle was safe to fly, and that the work the crew had been doing was vitally important and should be continued. Like most people at NASA, I felt that accomplishing those 2 things was the best way to honor Columbia's crew, and I'm sure it's what they would have wanted. I've never known an astronaut who doesn't believe that the work we do is far more important than we are as individuals. Every single person in our organization got behind the effort, despite the fact that morale was low and public support for the space program was even lower. The shuttle became a much safer vehicle, and we never lost another crew member. I never had another opportunity to fly on one, but I would have done so in a heartbeat. Sometimes, as with Challenger and Columbia, a vehicle fails, and there's absolutely nothing the crew can do. But sometimes there is. Astronauts have survived fires on the launch pad and in space. Ballistic landings, where the Soyuz has come back through the atmosphere like a rock hurled from space. Even a collision that punctured a spacecraft and caused sudden depressurization. In a real crisis like that, a group hug isn't going to save you. Your only hope is knowing exactly what to do and being able to do it, calmly and quickly. We're trained to look on the dark side and to imagine the worst things that could possibly happen. In fact, one of the most common questions we learn to ask ourselves is, okay, what's the next thing that'll kill me? Of course, much of what we learn is technically complex, but some of it is surprisingly down to earth. Every astronaut can fix a busted toilet. We have to do it all the time in space. And we all know how to pack meticulously, the way we have to in the Soyuz, where every last item must be strapped down just so, or the weight and balance get thrown off. The upshot of all this is that we become competent, which is the most important quality to have if you're an astronaut, or frankly, anyone anywhere who is striving to succeed at anything at all.
Garrick Hagan was reading from An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth by Chris Hadfield. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. Power Lister Assistant Commissioner Cressida Dick joins Jenny Murray on Womanza after the news. But first, it's all about food.
The kitchen cabinet is really the any questions of food. We get a good greedy audience into a big room. We put our panel before them and then they throw questions at each other. It's like being a ringmaster where you're keeping all sides in check and making sure the conversation bubbles along. It's about how we eat and what we eat, the best things to do with ingredients, novel things to do with ingredients. It's a good, noisy, greedy chat.
Join Jay Rayner for a new series of The Kitchen Cabinet on BBC Radio 4, next Tuesday afternoon at 3.